Fellas, you know Degree Cool Rush deodorant, right? Well, last year they changed the formula, and guys were mad about it. One dude even started a petition. So guess what? Degree heard us, admitted they messed up, and brought the original Cool Rush scent back exactly how it was. And it's in Walmart, Target, and other stores now for under $4. So grab some and remember why its cool, crisp, and fresh scent made it the number one men's antiperspirant for the last decade. Degree Cool Rush is back, and it smells like victory for all of us.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're here. And I'm here, too. Brett Baer is coming up in a matter of moments. Rich Lowry standing by, National Review. We have a lot happening today. One of my favorite moments of the Trump term, both one and two, is when he brings the cameras in to his cabinet meetings. He's already done it twice. Keep in mind, Joe Biden had 8 cabinet meetings in 4 years. And believe me, you didn't see much. He was, hello, this is what we look like. Please leave. Now, cameras roll. Takes questions. People answer. They talk about their different departments. But it's all exposed for television. So we have 100 days. We have a lot to look at. And the president was real pumped up after his appearance last night in Michigan. We also have some breaking news on the economy, which is not welcome news for the Trump team. And I'll bring it up to Brett in a moment. But let's get to the big three.
Number three.
And who's going to put out this fire? The opposition is important. But what's the proposition? What are Democrats offering besides, you know, outrage to Donald Trump and Elon Musk?
That is Van Jones. Dems trying to find their footing. They have Kamala today in a major speech that'll cost you. And ABC indicates they're ready for a major move. The problem? They're fueled by AOC, I should say. They are fueled by one thing, hatred of Trump. How's that working for you?
Number two.
Vice President Vance was in India last week. So I could see some announcements on India. I could see the contours of a deal with the Republic of Korea coming together.
So Republic of Korea could be the deal, and we hear India could be next. And man, the economy needs that. The beautiful bill is in markup now as Trump turns up the heat on would-be Republican heretics. Meanwhile, tariffs are taking a toll. What the president is doing is closing in on multiple deals, as you just heard.
Number one.
Donald Trump's first 100 days have been 100 days from hell.
Okay. I guess he's not for them. Tale of 200-day report cards. Trump says it's been heaven. As you heard, Chuck Schumer thinks it's hell. I say buckle up for the next 100 because Trump is ready to really, really rock the world in major ways. But this is not good news. This just came across. The U.S. GDP adjusted for inflation declined 0.3%. Now, it was 2.4 last quarter. It's to a 0.3% now minus for the first 3 months of the year. The Commerce Department said this Wednesday. It was on the surface a stunning reversal from the growth, but the first quarter figure was misleading. The results of quirks in the way economic activity is measured. More reliable data on consumer spending and business investment suggested the growth slowed in the first quarter but remained fundamentally solid. Bottom line is, that's a number Democrats are going to run with. Brett Baer, whose enterprising attitude had him saying hello to the president on his turf yesterday, knowing that he'd be tossing to his speech. He's the chief political anchor of Fox News. Brett, I saw you. What was it like to be part of the White House press corps yesterday?
Yeah, it was like the old job, you know. It was good. I figured I wanted to do the show from the White House as the backdrop, and there really had to be a reason to do that because we knew he was going to be in Michigan delivering that speech, and likely it was going to hit in our hour. So I went to the White House for the departure and got to ask him a few questions.
And you knew
left,
if you
so it was good.
You also knew if you saw him that he would go to you, right?
Yeah. I thought so. I mean, and it did work out that way. So, but they were very accommodating, letting me go in there, and it did bring me back to the old days. It was George W. Bush I was yelling at back then, but yeah, it was fun.
Multiple wars at that point. So, Brett, what's your reaction to this number? That's not going to be good news for the president.
No, it's not. You know, that's not a great number in any way, shape, or form. And you're right, Democrats will jump on that right away. A lot of it has to do with, you know, reaction to the tariffs and that there are so many balls in the air, as you just heard from the Treasury Secretary. they need some deliverables on deals to be blueprints for how other countries are going to make deals. And so that's not realized yet, and I think that's the limbo we're in as the slowing happens in the economy.
This is what the explanation is from the Economist and the New York Times. Say consumer spending slowed in the first quarter, growing at 1.8%, down from 4% at the end of last year. But economists said that there was at least in part because of harsh winter storms that hit the southern part of the state. Obviously, North Carolina is still recovering. There is little sign so far that the steep drop in consumer sentiment that began shortly after Trump took office has yet translated into a pullback in actual spending. But that number is not good. Do you think this creates an urgency to announce more deals?
Well, I think there was already pressure to do that. I think, you know, the market is hungry for some kind of concrete deal. You can only say we're closing in on a big trade deal so many times, and then it's like the, you know, Chicken Little. I think, you know, they're ready to do that. I'm told there's just dissension inside about what exactly each deal should look like. And so there may be a split between the Lutniks and the Bessents and the Navarros and the Greers, the USTR, which, by the way, I'm going to be at the trade reps agency today and do an interview with him, Jameson Greer.
Oh, he'll be on your show tonight?
Yeah. So we're taking the show on the road. We're doing it from USTR.
All right. Here is Scott Bed, the Treasury Secretary, yesterday, cut 22.
Vice President Vance was in India last week. I think that he and Modi made some very good progress, so I could see some announcements on India. I could see the contours of a deal with the Republic of Korea coming together, and then we've had substantial talks with the Japanese. I think that we are very close on India.
All right. So really close on India, and then I know that J.D. Vance made progress also with the president of Italy about the EU. So that would be next. As Kevin O'Leary said this morning or yesterday morning, he said, if you get India, you get Japan, you get the EU, that's 70% of what you need. The other countries, no disrespect, just don't have that a major pull. And I think now maybe you just come up with a template for what you need. Here's the figures they were. This is what we need. This is what we got, and sign this, and the markets might respond. Any indication that China's buckling?
No, and that's a big, you know, big question is will they feel the pinch? If you get these other deals, you know, India, Japan, South Korea, EU seems a little bit further off, but maybe it would put increasing pressure on China. A part of those deals have to do with, you know, increasing U.S. interaction and decreasing interaction between those countries and China. And I mean, there would really be a pinch. The question is how long China can hold out. They import a lot, and their economy is really, really hurting right now in the wake of all of this.
I want you to see, yes, I find it so interesting. It does not surprise me that my sound sheet is littered with Democrats who think Trump is the worst thing in the world. What, you know, what time is it? It's every day. But I also find it when Fetterman speaks out, when Joe Manchin used to be out there, because they're more issue to issue. Now, Governor Gretchen Whitmer, I want to get your take on this. She shows up in the Oval Office. She said after the election, President Trump is popular in Michigan. I'm going to work with him when I can. Then she showed up in the Oval Office, famously put her folder over her face, did not know the cameras were coming in, but didn't back off, had fun with it. And then yesterday when it was announced he was going to go to a National Guard base and announced the A-10 Warthog was going to be sidelined and they were getting new planes in as requested by her, she showed up. And then Trump said, hey, why don't you say a few words? Cut 26.
Well, I hadn't planned to speak, but I'm on behalf of all the military men and women who serve our country and serve so honorably on behalf of the state of Michigan, I am really damn happy we're here to celebrate this recapitalization at Selfridge. It's crucial for the Michigan economy. It's crucial for the men and women here, for our homeland security and our future. So thank you. I'm so, so grateful that this announcement was made today, and I appreciate all the work.
So is there going to be backlash, you think?
Probably. I mean, knowing how the Democratic Party eats their own on the left, there probably will be. You know, there was I saw a clip the other day, someone going on, a Democratic senator, I think it was Ruben Gallego, had voted for some ambassador in the Trump, you know, nomination, and was getting grilled about why he voted for that person. You know, so I think there will be, you know, and she may feel that. But, you know, notice it wasn't overwhelming as far as thanking President Trump in her remarks. I mean, she was pretty calculated. It wasn't exactly a folder in front of her face, but it was close to it.
But, you know, I think it's interesting. You have the oligarchy tour, which makes no sense, but they get big crowds. I don't think socialism or Bernie Sanders is the future of the party. Not many other experts feel that way. And then David Hogg comes out and says, I'm going to primary people I don't feel are effective. And he gets backlash from Ken Martin, the director, and others. So there's some friction there. And then you wonder if this is not the right path. Because Rahm Emanuel he's not eviscerating Trump. He has more of a up-the-middle approach anyway. So that's much different. As Democrats try to find their footing, I'm not sure anybody should be afraid of any backlash anywhere. You know, find out what the American people think. Don't worry about what, you know, people on your party think.
Yeah, totally agree. And I think all the focus right now on AOC and Bernie Sanders at J.B. Pritzker, you know, saying that there should be mass protests against President Trump and the Trump administration. I think those are all, you know, just seeking oxygen and trying to be the loudest voice in the room. In the end, by the time we get to the choosing the party, Democratic Party choosing which way forward, I would venture a guess there are some moderate choices, you know, the Wes Moores, the folks who are going to try to reach across the aisle at some point in their pitch. So we got a long way to go.
Big, beautiful bill. How long away did that have to go? The speaker says the markup went really well yesterday, by all accounts. Didn't even take them till midnight that they thought it would, as all the committees, all 12 committees were working to try to get something together in the House to offer to the Senate. And then they got to collaborate on one, not expecting any Democrat support. Question is, how many Republicans will they lose? Here's Speaker Johnson yesterday, cut 31.
We are on track to pass the bill out of the House, as we've said from the very beginning, and get it over to the next stage by Memorial Day. Now, I don't know how long the Senate's going to take to do their piece, but I was very encouraged after the meeting yesterday, frankly.
So do you think Memorial Day, from the people you talk to, Brett Baer, is possible?
Yeah, out of the House. I don't think it's all locked up by then, but I think it's sent over. And listen, you've got to give it to Speaker Johnson, who has pulled a rabbit out of many hats when people said there's no way he's going to hold these votes together, and he has. And obviously you have to give President Trump and the White House credit as well. But I think it's heading that way. We don't have the specifics yet. And there's going to be some anxiety along the way, but I do think that this tariff situation and even that number of the shrinking economy today may force some hands to move forward, that they need that growth agenda.
All right, Brett. And what was it like talking to the Washington Commanders owner? They're going to be thrilled to get that stadium closer to a metropolis like D.C., right?
Yeah, it's a big deal. You know, I think it's not baked in the cake. They still have to get through the D.C. Council, but I think that they're on their way, and I think it would be really big for the city and for the region. Obviously, Commanders fans, it's a big change to have it, you know, here.
I tell you, Brett, you lived it, but I had to drive there for the Army-Navy game. It's the middle of nowhere. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I mean, what were they thinking?
Yeah. It's amazing. And you sit there in traffic, you know, forever. And it's tough to get to. It just seemed that, RFK, that positioning is really easy. And the thing that's really going to change the dynamic is all the development around it. You know, Josh Harris talked about the restaurants and a boardwalk along the water. And, you know, I mean, it's a big thing for the city.
Just keep in mind, in New York, they promised that with the Islanders, and we're still waiting. They built the stadium, and then they kind of wait on the other stuff. Brett, thanks so much. Look forward to your, believe it or not, extremely impactful interview with Jameson Greer, because the whole world will be watching, because we want to find out what's the latest with the tariff drama. Brett Baer, thank you. All right, 1-866-408-7669. We'll take a short timeout. Come back with Rich Lowry in the National Review, who is not for these tariffs, by the way. Don't move.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Jimmy Failla, inviting you to join me for Fox Across America, where we'll discuss every single one of the Democrats' dumb ideas. Just kidding. It's only a three-hour show. Listen live at noon Eastern or get the podcast at foxacrossamerica.com.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
We're here tonight in the heartland of our nation to celebrate the most successful first 100 days of any administration in the history of our country, and that's according to many, many people. This is the best, they say, 100-day start of any president in history, and everyone is saying it. We've just gotten started. You haven't even seen anything yet. It's all just kicking in.
And by the way, the president was pumped up. I saw him Monday. It's not an act. He thinks he's doing fantastic. The tariff thing, the stare down, the unsettledness, according to Scott Bessin, it's part of the process and the negotiating. Yeah, the market doesn't love it, but get used to it. This is Trump time. We've been over 40,000 all week. They're actually coming out in the GDP being less, I'm sure will take a toll on the market at some point today when we open up. But we retracted 0.4%. So if that happens, they say, 3 months, 2 or 3 months in a row, it's a recession. But remember, when Joe Biden had that happen, he says it's not a recession. And everyone just agreed with it. Remember that? So the president last night was having a great time in Michigan. And he was also sat down with an interview on ABC. Here's a little of his exchange with Terry Moran. Remember, he said Stephanopoulos, no. Bill Muir, no. But he said yes to reporter Terry Moran. Cut three. I'm Pete Hegseth.
I want to ask one question about Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. There's a lot of turmoil at the Pentagon right now. There's the signal chat with his wife on it where he's discussing that attack in Yemen. There's another signal chat discussing the attack on Yemen. There's a reporter accidentally involved. You said the other day that you had a talk with the secretary. Did you take him to the woodshed?
I had a talk with him, and whatever I said, I probably wouldn't be inclined to tell you. But we had a good talk. He's a talented guy. He's young. He's smart, highly educated. And I think he's going to be a very good defense, hopefully a great defense secretary, but he'll be a very good defense secretary.
You have 100% confidence in Peter.
I don't have 100% confidence in anything. Okay? Anything. Do I have 100%? It's a stupid question. Look.
It's a pretty important position.
No. You don't have 100%. Only a liar would say I have 100% confidence. I don't have 100% confidence that we're going to finish this interview.
We will.
Let's go.
Right. I was surprised. Allison, are you surprised that he got offended by the 100%?
I guess a little surprised, but his response back was perfect.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, you mean, I don't even know this, how we're going to
100% this interview is going to end.
Right. And I'm going to play a little bit more of a confrontational interview. Trump handled it fine. But there, I just can't believe the focus on everybody worried about these legal immigrant criminals and getting their day in court. I asked Jonathan Turley on the break today. It wasn't my interview. So I said, Jonathan, how is it that Barack Obama sent out 350,000 people and none of them got a day in court? And Trump has got to give them all a day in court. And he says, it's really a gray area. That's why the Enemies Act needs to get passed. So fascinating to see someone like Jonathan Turley saying it's kind of up in the air because we can't get rid of 8 million people. It's impossible to give them all a hearing, let alone the criminals and the gotaways that we catch.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
There is a lot of concern out there. People are worried, even some people who voted for you saying, I didn't sign up for this. So how do you answer those concerns?
Well, they did sign up for it, actually, and this is what I campaigned on. I said that we've been abused by other countries at levels that nobody's ever seen before. We were losing $3 to $5 billion a day on trade. We were losing $1.5 trillion to $2 trillion a year, not sustainable. They were taking advantage of us like they've never. I could have left it that way, and at some point it would have been an implosion like nobody's ever seen. But I said, no, we have to fix it.
So that is the president sitting down with Terry Moran of ABC, a bit contentious back and forth, but also shows the focus. The focus is so much for these illegal alien criminals, it's incredible. I'm not saying it's not an issue, but to at least start and say, Mr. President, and I don't think this is a throwaway or a kiss-ass question. When you started, there were 4,000 or 7,000 people coming through a day. Now we're down to 133, and over the last 4 months, only 9 have gotten through. What has been the key to the success? And then you could build it towards, here's where the controversy is. But there's just no acknowledgement that they have done something at the border that nobody else, even including, I don't know, Trump and Tom Omen, thought was imaginable. But between the military, the cooperation from Mexico, and we still don't know all the answers, and a motivated Border Patrol, this has happened and it has stopped. But that's where they focused. Everybody's focused on Kilmore and others. But in the meantime, we just did get bad economic news. The GDP grew, and it's going to be could be revised at 0.3%, minus 0.3%. The market's not liking that. They're down 469 points at this hour. Let's bring in Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. Hey, Rich.
Hey, how's it going?
What's your reaction to the economic numbers?
Excuse me. It's not a great number, obviously. But it's a little kind of squirrely stuff going in there. I didn't realize, Brian, did you, that imports subtract from the GDP number?
So
there's a surge of imports, which might be people just getting stuff in ahead of the tariffs, which would indicate there's going to be a fall off of imports ahead here, and some other technical things going on. But it's not a great number. It's not a great headline number, and I'm not sure we're going to be better in this quarter. So there's turbulence out there, and turbulence that President Trump did not prepare people for during the campaign. So I think this is a rough patch ahead.
But he did prepare him for the tariffs. He did say he was going to do that on just about everybody.
He did, yeah. It's hard to think of anything he's done that he didn't say he was going to do during the campaign, very much including the tariffs. He had talked about 10%, maybe 20%. It was clear he really liked tariffs, right? He told us that over and over again. But he did sugarcoat any potential downsides. You know, if you say we're going to have a golden age, but might be some empty store shelves before then and things get more expensive, people like say, I'm not sure I would sign up for that golden age. But that's where we are. So he either has to back off or just fight through this.
Or, yeah, start cutting deals. That's a great headline you had. The golden age is coming. But until then, stock up on toilet paper. And you talk about the approval numbers the first 100 days. Personally, I just don't think his agenda is built for 100 days. I mean, everything he's doing is framing out a whole new arrangement with the world on trade, the military buildup, three wars he's trying, three potential conflicts he's trying to bring back, the one with Iran, Russia, Ukraine, as well as Israel and Gaza. So he's trying to do all that at the same time. So, foreign policy, it's under 50. Well, he's got no answers yet, but he's only been there three months. So when it comes to the economy, we got no deals yet, but he just announced less than a month ago that blanket tariffs and restructuring. Here's what Howard Lutnick said. He said he announced a deal with an unidentified country. I think it's South Korea. He says it's done, but I need to wait for their prime minister and their parliament to give its approval, which I expect shortly. So that would begin to turn the tide, one would think.
Yeah, I think that certainly the market would welcome that. South Korea, India, Japan, UK, the sooner we can do it, the better. My take, Brian, is that if he wanted better deals, he could have gotten them without doing this, because he could have gone to these countries and just made threats that I think they would have considered very credible. And then there's still that 145% tariff on China. Now, no one's crying over China getting tariffed real bad, but that's hugely disruptive just because we're so intertwined with China. Just such a shock that I think is going to lead to, even if nothing else was going on, that alone would lead to a lot of economic disruption. So I'm not a fan of the tariffs. I think on the other stuff, it's clearly too soon to tell, right? You know, where is it going to come out on the Ukraine war? What's going to happen with Gaza? But this, I think, was going about it this way was a mistake.
So there's a drop in Chinese exports already, and almost all indications it's a tough country to figure out. But they are struggling economically. There's a whole generation's not working, and the whole command economy not effective, although they're trying to reinstate things like Alibaba and others to get some a bit of free market principles in there. But in terms of the Chinese exports, in April of 2024, it was up at 50.6%. In April of 2025, it's 44.7%. So that might not look a lot, but in a month, that's significant. So we're going to see, because a lot of orders of produced products are being canceled, because when they add the 145% in, people are saying, yeah, in small business America, I can't afford that product. Keep it in your port. So we'll see what happens, because I was told by a high-ranking official off camera that there absolutely are talks going on with China at a lower level right now.
Yeah, I think one way or the other, the 145 is going down, whether Trump just decides, well, actually another number would be better, or whether there's some sort of deal with China. But all the indications are, I'm not a logistics expert, Brian, but, you know, I follow these people on X now, and they're saying, you know, these containers are empty, they're coming over, you know, and then what happens, right? The trucker doesn't have work because there's nothing in the container for him to ship somewhere in the United States. So I think this will have major ripple effects. And again, for my money, it was unduly disruptive. There would have been other ways to get at the goals he wants besides doing it this way.
So I want you to hear his exchange with Terry Moran yesterday on China. Cut 15.
But it's the tariffs, right? We still have 145% tariffs on China. Your Treasury Secretary said we basically have an embargo on China.
Look, you're trying to say something's going to happen,
Terry. No, okay, well,
nothing's going to happen.
You know business. I want to ask you.
I do know business.
Yes, so 145% tariffs on China, and that is basically an embargo.
They deserve it.
It'll raise prices on everything from electronics to clothing to building houses.
You don't know that. You don't know whether or not China's going to eat it.
That's mathematics.
China probably will eat those tariffs, but at 145, they basically can't do much business with the United States. And they were making from us $1 trillion a year. They were ripping us off like nobody's ever ripped us off.
So that's a little of the exchange back and forth.
Yeah. One, it's a questionable choice having Terry Moran do this interview on the one hand. On the other hand, it's very illuminating, right? And very, very entertaining.
Yeah.
Trump enjoys these exchanges, and we just see, you know, back and forth between interviewers and presidents that you've never seen before. Look, China deserves it. There's no doubt. You know, China has truly ripped us off. It's carried out one of the greatest acts of theft in world history in stealing all our intellectual property. They've cheated on the WTO in ways that the WTO was never set up to handle. Yeah, so I think Trump has been right about China all along. He was right when the bipartisan consensus was wrong. He was right when I was wrong about China. I just don't think I would have been more strategic about this. And I think he'll end up having to back off the 145 because, yeah, it's hurting China, but the problem is also going to hurt us.
Right. And there's no doubt about it. The reconfiguring is unsettling to so many people. So we'll see what happens from here on in. But I will tell you, my observation is Trump was extremely happy to be out and about. And there was a raucous crowd that was greeting him last night. Here he goes. Cut one.
We're here tonight in the heartland of our nation to celebrate the most successful first 100 days of any administration in the history of our country. And that's according to many, many people. This is the best, they say, 100-day start of any president in history, and everyone is saying it. We've just gotten started. You haven't even seen anything yet. It's all just kicking in.
Right. Of course, an example of how Democrats feel, Jimmy Gomez, the congressman from California, cut 24.
If there was ever going to be a movie written about this 100 days, it would be How to Destroy the World's Greatest Economy in 100 Days or Less, because that's exactly what he did.
How could we be living on the same planet? Who's right?
Well, I think there's economic disruption, but the economy isn't being destroyed. And, you know, Trump said at the end of the campaign, he held a rally, and he was like, this is the last rally I'm going to hold. Like, no, it's not. It might be the last campaign rally, but he's so good in that setting and loves it so much. Obviously, there are going to be rallies all during his presidency, and there's one last night. I was watching him earlier, you know, on our air, and I just, if I'm a Democrat looking at him, I got to think, like, this guy is so audacious. He's so optimistic. You know, he's so all out there. He's so charismatic. Where do we get someone like that? And the fact is, I don't think they ever will. You know, they don't have one. And it's the reason he's been dominant in our politics for 10 years now.
I know. And we've never seen anything quite like it. I saw him on Monday, had a chance to see him casually, just no cameras. And just in my comparison, having known him, I've never seen him happier, ever, mm-hmm. ever. Mm-hmm. He knows everything we just said and that you said and that you wrote. He knows, he knows these are on his desk, but he feels like he's on top of it. He does not mind the tumult. He thinks it plays towards making a deal.
This is the situation he relishes, right? It's happened over and over again in the last 10 years. He's in some fix, and you're like, how possibly is he going to survive? How possibly is he going to get out of this, right? And all the tension is on him, all the pressure is on him, and he finds a way out. So, again, I wouldn't have done it this way, but the optimistic scenario, you get a bunch of deals. You get the big, beautiful bill that cuts regulation and taxes, and you're in a better place towards the end of the year.
All right. Yesterday, Governor Gretchen Whitmer showed up at the National Guard base to talk about the A-10 being swapped out for the F-16s, brand new F-16s. That's what she actually requested of Trump, and he did it. So he says, why don't you show up and greet me? And he did. She did. And then she was asked to speak, and she did reluctantly. Who do you think is right? Governor Pritzker to say was fight Republicans everywhere, don't give him a moment of peace, don't let him rest? Or Governor Whitmer, who shows up in the Oval Office, covers her face comically. I mean, just unbelievable, like a child, right? Hide and seek, I'll just cover my eyes. And then she shows up at this base again. Who's got it right? And traditionally, it used to not be that big of a deal for a governor from another party to show up with a president. But with this president, it's different. So what long term, who's got better political prospects by their actions, Pritzker or Whitmer?
You have to say Pritzker, just because that's what the base of the party is going to want. But I would say just none of the above. If these are my two choices, I'd go with choice C, which is John Fetterman. He's like, yeah, sure, you meet with the president, but, you know, I hate a lot of things he's doing. But I'm also going to say F you to my side when they're crazy. And that's what they really need. They need someone that's totally outside of this woke industrial complex that has a grip on the party, whether it's Fetterman. I mean, he's not going to run, or Stephen A. Smith. I'm a little skeptical he's going to run or would make it if he did. But someone who's different. They desperately need someone who's different.
I hear you. Rich, we'll see how this goes. We'll see what happens. We know there's no 2 days the same. I can't wait for the cabinet meeting today. I mean, that should be in the TV guide.
Have you ever said that before?
Right. I know. We're going to get to see it. So you see how they interact with Trump. You see the questions. Also, important to point out, Susie Wiles announced yesterday Elon Musk is not going to be coming to the White House every day. He'll do his work from outside through phone calls and obviously FaceTime. Your thoughts?
Well, this is clearly where it was going to head eventually. I mean, Elon's a very busy guy. Right? He's got several world historical companies to run, and Doge, the way it was run, was chaotic. The impulse was correct, but was annoying a lot of even Trump people. So it was clear that the pace and the intensity of it the last several months weren't sustainable.
Rich Lowry, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
All right, and pick up National Review. That's why. 1-866-408-7669. Now, look, Trump probably doesn't love this headline. The golden age is coming, Trump says, but until then, stock up on toilet paper. But there's no sense in writing columns that just praise any politician or any party. You have to be discerning and judge within it, or else you're just not worth listening to or reading. That's in my view. What do you think? 1-866-408-7669.
In-depth analysis, insightful commentary, probing questions.
What's a furry again?
I'll tell you.
Thinks they're an animal?
Sure.
It's Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
This wasn't the Australian outback. This was Alabama.
This runaway kangaroo named Sheila, back home now after she shut down an interstate.
Who no doubt by tonight has her own Instagram account.
You have that on your bingo card for 2025, a kangaroo down I-85 in Alabama.
So that was a little crazy, but that got into some crazy talk. This is what we were talking about online, right? On X and Instagram, we were on live. How crazy it is to see a kangaroo in Alabama.
That's how it started, but that's not where the conversation ended. But yes, you, Lawrence, Carly, yes, the kangaroo started it, and then the conversation about marsupials, then you were asking what's the point of llamas, and then your profound hate of pandas came up. Right. So we talked about all the animals, but well, go to your Instagram to watch.
Well, here's the thing, and I have not asked Pete or Eric this, but don't you think that kangaroos could go faster if they ran? Like, why are they hopping? Like, you know, we'd all hop. But, like, you have the big, strong legs. They move quickly. Why not run? Do you have any idea, Eric? I know.
I don't.
You thought about it?
I would think that they just, you know, that's how they evolved. That they're faster if they jump.
Do you think they can run and are choosing not to?
I don't think they could run well.
That's a good question. I don't know if they can run. Maybe they can walk or, you know, kind of.
But do you ever get people say, well, you know, I could beat you lefty or I could beat you running backwards? Do you think kangaroos are saying, I'm so fast, I could beat you hopping?
I think they could beat us hopping.
Yeah. Right.
But I mean, it's because they also have the small upper, like.
Yeah, small upper body.
Yeah. So, like, they can't run on all fours.
Terrible build.
And to run with, like, a human wouldn't really work either because they have the big tail, which helps them a lot with balance.
Right.
So, you know, I don't think. Could they? Yes. But would it be good? No.
Right. I tell you, it's always a treat, except when I was in Australia, when you're with Australians and they see a kangaroo, they don't even blink an eye.
Well, they're like, because they're like deer to us. They're all over. They get hit on the highway. You just see them grazing on the side of the road. It's, you know, kangaroos are our deer.
I don't think they're as common as deer.
No?
Because we don't have deer in a zoo, right?
Sometimes.
Kangaroos are still in a zoo.
Sometimes you have deer in a zoo. The smaller ones are the different breeds.
Really?
I mean, when's the last time you were at a zoo, Brian?
I was at a zoo in Australia, actually.
Well, they wouldn't have right. deer at a zoo
and
in
by
Australia.
By the way, the koala bear, the hugging koala bear, yeah. they let the koala, it's not a fable. When you put a koala bear near you, they hug you.
Yeah, because they don't want to fall.
Trolley, yeah.
They got a good grip. They're also marsupials,
I just FYI. Thought there was a sense of bonding.
Yeah.
You just said it's a.
Oh, you felt the connection with the koala?
Yes, until now.
And then you found out he hugs everyone.
Then I found out it's not just me. I had no idea. You know, my brother was the one who always liked the animal stuff. I just said to myself, what is the point? You sit all day. I just think to myself how boring it must be for that cameraman to sit all day and wait for the lion to do something, you know, chase down a zebra.
But when the action's there, it's really there.
True.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
All right, from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, it's Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way. Moments from now, the New York Post finest columnist, Michael Goodwin, will be joining us, talking about the 100 days in his perspective, knows President Trump personally, but doesn't stop him from calling him out when he feels like it's necessary. General Jack Keane at the bottom of the hour, if I want to get perspective on what the reality is with Russia and Ukraine, you have to call General Keane, also the reality of what Iran is approaching our talks, you know, in Oman and Italy, whatever. I think it's a dry hole. It's a waste of time. They still got ballistic missiles. They're still supplying weapons and money to their proxies. They're still supplying drones over to Russia. This regime's got to end, and this might be the best time. How does he feel about that? So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Who's going to put out this fire? The opposition is important, but what's the proposition? What are Democrats offering besides, you know, outrage to Donald Trump and Elon Musk?
Exactly. Van Jones hasn't been booked much because he is not outraged about Donald Trump, and he knows what happened in the last election. Dems trying to find their footing, and they're doing it through Kamala Harris. She's got a major speech today, and, of course, she's charging for it, and AOC indicates she might be running for president. The problem? They're only fueled by one thing. Hatred of Donald Trump. Ladies and gentlemen, that doesn't fly.
Number two.
Vice President Vance was in India last week, so I could see some announcements on India. I could see the contours of a deal with the Republic of Korea coming together.
That is the Treasury Secretary, the most important voice in this administration. Beautiful bill in makeup, is in markup right now as Trump turns up the heat and would-be Republican heretics. Meanwhile, tariffs are taking a toll. We have economic numbers that aren't good, and it's tanking the market today.
Number one.
Donald Trump's first 100 days have been 100 days from hell.
That is, according to Chuck Schumer, tale of 200-day report cards. Trump says it's been heaven. You heard what Chuck Schumer says. I say buckle up, because if you thought the first 100 were exciting, the next 100 will triple your excitement. So right now, Peter Navarro went in front of the cameras to relax the markets. That never works. Secretary of Treasury Scott Bessent should be the only one talking. I think Lutnick has taken a step back, and I think one person, one mind, because when you have a GDP as minus 0.3, that's a lot different from 1.4, where we were at. Joining us now is Michael Goodwin. So, Michael, before I even talk about the 100 days, let's talk about the markets right now.
Yeah, it's a lot of red arrows, huh?
Yes.
Red's never good. Red's not the color you want to see on your market screen.
So, yeah, and it says a lot to do with the growth. The economy shrank in the first quarter, but they say it's not really as it appears. This is going to the New York Times. So they say that the U.S. GDP adjusted for inflation declined at 0.3% annual rate for the first time of the year. The Commerce Department said Wednesday, though, is on the surface a stunning reversal from the 2.4 last quarter. But the first quarter, they say, this is New York Times, was misleading, the result of quirks in the way government data is measured. The surge in imports as businesses and consumers race to get ahead of expected tariffs hurt the growth, believe it or not. More reliable data on consumer spending and business investment suggested that growth slowed in the first quarter but remained fundamentally solid this quarter. So I'm just reading you what the New York Times said. But still, it shows how unsettled the situation is right now. We can agree on that.
Yes. The old line, right? Lies, damn lies, and statistics, particularly economic statistics, are always very difficult to parse, and they don't always mean what it looks like they mean, and this is a good example of that. So good for the Times for trying to explain it and not just jumping on the easy headline, which is Trump sinks America, let's say.
Here's Trump last night, cut one.
We're here tonight in the heartland of our nation to celebrate the most successful first 100 days of any administration in the history of our country, and that's according to many, many people. This is the best, they say, 100-day start of any president in history, and everyone is saying it. We've just gotten started. You haven't even seen anything yet. It's all just kicking in.
So the crowd was raucous. He was happy. I saw him Monday. He was happy. The polls say he's ever at 40% everywhere, just over 55% when it comes to border security. But we also know that 92% of all the mainstream media reporting has been negative. When you hear nonstop negative drumbeat, it doesn't matter really what you do. Some people get convinced of that.
Yes, I think that does play a big role, Brian. For the 100 days measurement, as I wrote in my column today, I think the best way to do it is to divide it into two parts. There's pre-tariff and there's post-tariff. And the pre-tariff part was sensational. I mean, you had the border right out of the gate. I mean, what he's done there, reducing the flow by 95% over what it was in March of a year ago. You just had, I mean, he got the confirmation of his cabinet quickly. All of that, I think, was handled extremely professionally. They got just a lot of momentum on a lot of things. I mean, going after the schools on the anti-Semitism, all the executive orders on gender and trans men in sport and women's sports, all of these things, the DEI culture. I mean, he really took on the culture wars. He took on sort of the political wars and all of the financial issues. All of that happens early. The stock market is soaring. In mid-February, everything hits new highs. And then on April 2nd, Liberation Day, it changes everything. It's almost instant when you look back at sort of the flow of things, that the public began to, because the stock market sank, because people saw their 401ks going down, the retirement funds talk, there was lots of talk of recession, inflation, you know, trade wars. Yep. The word war itself, I think, is unnerving to a lot of people, even though we're not talking about actual military. But there was a sense, at best, of uncertainty and, at worst, disaster. And this really took a toll on the president's standing. And I think it's created in the country a kind of uncertainty about what happens next. And it's called into question the president's judgment. He stands by the tariff thing. He believes that this will work out. I spoke to him again Monday, and he is confident this will work out, that meanwhile, America's collecting a lot of money at the ports of entry, collecting the tariffs from various companies, you know, companies and countries. But I think he's got to begin to deal with the public fears here now, because it's taking a toll on his poll. People are worried about his handling of the economy, which, of course, is one of the reasons he was elected, because he was so much better on the economy than the Biden-Harris people. So he's got some work to do, but he's sticking to it. And as far as inflation, he said to me Monday again, look, the price of energy is low. And when the price of energy is low, you're not going to have real inflation, because energy is such an important component of everything. So that's his sense of confidence that American strength will prevail, that these countries and companies need our customers, need American customers to survive. And so he believes they will all come around to some reasonable accommodation on the tariffs.
So this is what the economists are saying. It says, understand why the boom in imports led to a decline in the GDP. It helps understand a bit about the numbers calculator. The GDP, they say, as the name suggests, is meant to measure only goods produced domestically, not imports, which are produced abroad. But rather than measure production directly, the government counts all the goods and services sold in the country and then subtracts the ones that were made overseas. Well, guess what we rushed to do? Bring in everything possible overseas before the tariffs hit. Yeah. So that forced the GDP in the other direction. They expect it to be revised up next quarter. And this is not the spin from the White House. This is the New York Times reporting these numbers. And I wish I had time to analyze it, but it just happened in real time and we're doing a live show. So that's really where we're at. So the president feels, hold on tight, it's going to be okay. Josh Hawley weighed in too. He's firmly in the president's corner in these 100 days, cut 9.
He was up there for 90 minutes. I was just thinking to myself, Joe Biden couldn't stand there for 90 seconds. You know, I mean, what a contrast to see a real leader. And the other thing that struck me was, for the first time in 30 years, America finally has a president who is for the working people of this nation. And he is delivering a Republican Party that is finally for the working people of this nation. Joe Biden beat them down. He sold them out. He suppressed their wages. He sent our jobs to China. He put men into girls' sports. He did everything he could to destroy the working class of this country that's the backbone of this country. And Trump is rebuilding it. He's got the vision for it. And look at the results. It's been astounding.
And at least for now, the Republicans are together to get this bill across the finish line without boring people with the mechanics of it. I don't think they can wait till September to pass it. The House wants to get this done by Memorial Day and the Senate before July 4th. You know these players. Do you think it's possible?
Well, as an aside, I mean, the president certainly wants it sooner. He wants it as soon as possible. He thinks it's a very important bill in terms of tax cuts and other changes in the tax laws. But whether they can do it, look, I think so far the Republicans have overperformed as to what I thought they would do. I think Johnson has been pretty successful in the House, and Thune delivered the confirmation process very well. So I think they can do it. The House, of course, is the tricky part with the margin so close. You only need a couple of rebels, refuseniks, and they are there waiting for their issues to come up. And I think the president is going to have to get involved, as he did before, and twist some arms, because this is now, I think, a part of the confidence of his presidency. And a lot of it rides on this bill. But more important, I think, even, Brian, in the short term, is a few successful trade negotiations would do a lot to lift the fear that we're headed downhill. Even a few, even five or four, something like that would give the sense of momentum moving towards solutions across the board. That's what I think they need, and that's what we haven't seen yet.
And we have, that would put pressure on China, too. Real quick, on the media, we've been seeing these books written now about Joe Biden's failures, his cognitive decline, how little he was doing, the story of the auto pen. But then we have the Axios reporter get up on the at the Washington, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and admit the media lost trust because they failed to report the cognitive decline of the president. Chuck Todd, of all people, who was as complicit as anyone, said this about the media, denying they were wrong. Cut 37.
This is not a media failure. This is a failure of the Democratic Party. And I just sort of the virtue signaling that some people have done to try to say that the media missed this story. They didn't miss this story. So, David Ignatius wrote, I just refuse to accept this stupid premise because it's a right-wing manufactured right-wing premise in order to stain the media.
Is he out of his mind? Could he be that detached from reality? Your thoughts, Michael.
Well, what does he mean? The media didn't miss the story. They didn't cover the story. The only question is whether their failure to do their jobs was intentional or just a mistake. I mean, I think that's the argument. I think it's intentional. I believe that the media, the Washington Press Corps, hates Donald Trump as much as Nancy Pelosi does. And they do the bidding of Democrats. They're all Democrats. They're all for the left. They're all for every Democrat. If you check their voting patterns, every one of them would vote for every Democratic candidate. And that's what's happened to the media. That's why it's lost favor with the Republic. Not because people are all Republicans, but it's because they don't trust them. They don't trust you're getting a straight story. Your thumb is on the scale every time you write when you're at the New York Times, when you're at the Washington Post. There's nothing fair about it, and so you're not credible. And that's what the Chuck Todds of the world refuse to accept. They have destroyed public trust in their institutions. This is a very big event in American life. I don't think we've ever seen it so one-sided. And so what the White House is trying to do, and I applaud this, is bring in more outlets to democratize access to the president and to the White House. And I think it's a great thing. I think what Caroline Leavitt and the others in the administration are doing to open the door to the White House to people who aren't just from the New York Times and the Washington Post and ABC, et cetera, so that more people can spread the word of what's actually going on. You would think that our free press would want to have a democracy about the press, but they don't. They want a monopoly. They want to act like a trade union that once they're inside the door gets locked.
Michael Goodwin, thanks so much. You were never in denial. Believe me, if Donald Trump was walking around not knowing how to get off a stage, if he was rambling incoherently, if he refused to meet with the press for months on end, if he put a lid at 10:30 in the morning, you would write that column. Absolutely. You would say, this is not the Trump I know. This is not how you become president. And if you didn't, it would be your fault and my fault. Chuck Todd, not understanding his host to meet the press, and he also has a daily podcast, not to report that the president's invisible and cannot physically walk across a lawn and say it's not the media fault, it's Democrats' fault, or a right-wing talking point, is insanity. No wonder he's not at NBC anymore. Michael, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you, Brian.
Back in a moment.
both sides, all opinions. It's Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We are very fickle in this country. We forget. You know, you can be mad at one side or the other, but you have to stick with facts. And the facts are, we left good stuff. He has pooped on it.
Okay, that is Whoopi Goldberg, economist. I believe she's an economist. No, I'm sorry, comedian. My fault. Who used to be funny, I guess, during her day when she was doing a one-woman show. So there you go. She thinks that Donald Trump got left this great thing, this great economy, and messed it up. If you look at what the president's been handed in terms of the Middle East on fire, South China on the march, South China Sea is being overwhelmed by China. Then you see Russia trying to re-influence Eastern Europe and recapture it little by little. And then you find out the Abraham Accords that he left, which was peaceful. Now we have a situation where we got an active war. You have Israel being attacked from seven sides and little by little knocking them out. So he's got a lot of balls, a lot of oars in the water. But Whoopi Goldberg's assessment that everything was great, everything was structured poorly. The trade deals had to be redone. If you want to challenge Trump, maybe on the way he did it all at once, maybe depending on the speed and velocity in which he cuts these deals. If they start coming in rapidly, they will put jet fuel into the economy. But the number on the GDP, we had lost as many as 700 points. It's down to 492, and the market's over 40,000 again. When we come back, General Jack Keane breaks down the challenges. What Russia put on the table yesterday shows, in my humble view, they are not close to serious about any type of peace. Now they're proposing a three-day ceasefire to celebrate their victory in World War II. Many people say, don't buy it. And why are you walking away from a 30-day ceasefire that was offered to you about 3 weeks ago?
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
If this doesn't stop, the Ukrainians aren't winning the war. I think there's this weird idea among the mainstream media that if this thing goes on for just another few years, the Russians will collapse, the Ukrainians will take their territory back, and everything will go back to the way that it was before the war. That is not the reality that we live in.
So that is the Vice President of the United States. That's what his assessment of what's happening on the ground in Ukraine. Well, the chairman of the Institute of Study of War, four-star General Jack Keane, Fox News contributor, he's our senior strategic analyst, has his point of view, and he joins us now. General, what do you think about what the Vice President said?
I think the Ukrainians do have opportunity to take some territory back by persistent counterattacks, but they have to be given increased lethality to do that. But in terms of driving the Russians completely out, I think that's unlikely. He's right about that. But what he hasn't said is the point that needs to be made, because there's an absolute false narrative out there that if the West continues to support Ukraine, Russia will not take control of Ukraine, period. We're 38 months into this war, And Russia has taken 20% of the territory, and most of that territory they had already owned before the invasion. So they have, when you think about it, 38 months. How much progress have they really made beyond 2014, when they already owned close to that 20%? It has not been operationally significant. Russia cannot take control of Ukraine if we continue to arm them and protract the war. That's where we're at. The problem we have is Zelensky and the people of Ukraine want to make peace. They have demonstrated that by removing any concessions for a 30-day ceasefire. Putin has rejected that 30-day ceasefire, thrown up all these phony ceasefires that have nothing to do with a quasi-permanent ceasefire, and are clearly demonstrating that they're not interested in really making a peace deal. And I think we've got to accept that and make attempts to force them into negotiations. Take the gloves off, and let's start dealing with them realistically.
So General Chris Cavoli, commander of the U.S. forces in Europe, told the Senate committee this month that the Russian army, which has been borne the brunt of the combat, is today larger than it was at the beginning of the war. And they are beginning to expand their bases in their country. Danish intelligence warned that the Russians could launch a large-scale war in Europe within 5 years if it perceived NATO to be weak. Have they just gone full military economy and would be almost hurt them to stop this war because it's keeping them busy with jobs?
Yeah, so far, the people are supporting this, and a couple of reasons for that. Yes, to answer your first question, they have gone to a war footing economy. In other words, they have taken industries that normally produce commercial products, and they are doing what we did in World War II. They're making military items, not as sophisticated, you know, as a tank, but making items that they need on the battlefield, and there's thousands of those items. Yes, and they in the attitude of the people, while the economy has suffered, they're not impoverished as a result of it. It's not, and it hasn't crippled them. Why? Because China and India have bailed them out, you know, in terms of purchasing their oil and their gas. And they've had significant plus ups from Iran, China, and North Korea in terms of military assistance. So their support has been pretty steady. And the other thing, Putin goes out of his way to make certain that he recruits from Central and Eastern Russia, not from Western Russia, where the power structure is. And if a soldier dies on the battlefield, regardless of where the family is and regardless of what their social economic state is, they get close to $150,000 in equivalent rubles. Which, if they had three males in the family working, it would exceed what the income of the three males are. So he's bought their silence and their support. He paid attention to what happened in Afghanistan, 10 years of commitment and casualties every single year mounting, so much to the point the people were fed up with it, and it was the people that convinced the Soviet Union leadership to pull out of this thing. So he has cleverly kept this away from Western Russia, from the elites. And while I haven't been in Moscow in a while, the people I know who have been there said, hey, everyday life is the same. There's traffic. The clubs are busy. The restaurants are full. People are having a normal middle-class life experience there, and you wouldn't know a war is going on. So he can sustain this. In terms of warfighting the economy and also support from the people. But he does have a couple of problems, and the losses he's taken are significant, Brian. And in 2025, it's going to come to a head, and it's going to force him. I mean, we're talking about almost 30,000 casualties a month, and he's going to have to go to some kind of mobilization. And likely it may have to involve the western part of his country. Mm-hmm. That'll put more pressure on him than he's ever seen. And he's been resisting that. Now, the other thing, his goals in terms of Eastern Europe, the Baltics, certainly Moldova, which is not a part of NATO, which would be easy for him. I'm talking about occupying these countries. He has put more troops on the border of Finland than they have had going all the way back to the Cold War and to World War II. So, yes, he has a piece of his military that he is not using. And he has not given up his ambitions, not only to take control of Ukraine, but also to take back some of those Eastern European countries that used to be a part of the Soviet Union.
So, Lavrov, if you want to know how serious they are, too, you can just see what they say publicly. Lavrov was evasive on Face the Nation on CBS. But he told a Brazilian newspaper, he insisted that Russia will accept nothing less than total victory over Ukraine. And he said that he said that to Witkoff. They said they want international recognition of Crimea, Sevastopol, Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhzhia regions as part of Russia. it's an imperative, insisting that not just the world, but also Kyiv itself recognize that 20% of Ukraine is now sovereign Russian territory. That's a pretty bold statement for somebody who's is supposed to be a diplomat.
Yeah, I mean, Lavrov is speaking the truth there. I mean, they still want to control Ukraine, and that's Putin's goal, and you got to know that. And a peace agreement, even if he agreed to a peace agreement, Putin looks at it as temporary, just to appease the Trump team, and he'll rearm in the meantime China. Certainly Iran and North Korea will assist him. His defense industrial base will recover on its own. The sanctions will be removed, obviously, as opposed to imposing more sanctions, and he'll attack. That's the point, and you've got to understand that. When it comes to Crimea, I think the administration is off here. I mean, we all know that Russia occupies Crimea. Should it have happened? Should the Biden administration done something about it? Yes, but that's history. But you got to think of Crimea the way that we thought of East Germany post-World War II. East Germany became part of the Soviet Union, but nobody ever recognized it. No international community recognized that as being an integral part of Russia and the Soviet Union. And the reason for that is because governments change and policies change. So the government changed in 91 as a result of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and East Germany returned to Germany. Crimea is obviously occupied by Russia, just as the Soviet Union occupied East Germany. The government in Russia will change at some point. It may not be the next change, but it could be the following change, that an agreement is reached for reasons that will be of that country's interest at the time, to give up something that is not really theirs and they took illegally. And Ukraine gets back Crimea. We should not recognize Crimea legally as being a part of Russia. Do we understand they occupy it? Yes. Do we understand they're going to occupy it for a number of years? Yes. But it's wrong to think that this is gone forever. History says no. And I think that the right thing to do is obviously just take it off the table and stop even dealing with it would be the right thing to do and focus on everything else.
I mean, there's no doubt about it. There's diplomatic language that the president's not really, you know, familiar with, because that's not his area. That you could say you could bring this war to an end and don't have to acknowledge that the area that was stolen by the aggressive power is theirs. You could just say we recognize these borders, but you could say you don't recognize the theft of land with using more diplomatic terms, right?
Right. And that's why there's not a single country, to include China, has recognized Crimea being a part of Russia. I mean, the international community kind of gets it. This is occupied territory. That is different than saying it is part of Russia legally. And we didn't do that post-World War II, and I don't think we should do it now. And it's a concession that we just really don't have to make. Leave it alone.
So Jennifer Griffin pointed this out on Sunday, that to have Steve Witkoff walk into a meeting with Vladimir Putin by himself without any Russian experts, knowing that he spent the bulk, Henry Kissinger wouldn't walk in by himself, spending his whole life in diplomacy and writing books about the Soviet Union. Why would he walk in there without Russian experts? And he walks in there, and I don't see anything coming out of this. I mean, do you see any results yet that they're encouraging from your sources?
Well, I mean, when I was told, as a result of the numerous meetings that he's had, particularly with Putin, he walks out of those meetings believing Putin, because, I mean, he's a trained KGB operative, experience in using lies to manipulate people's behavior. This is a skill set that he was trained at and used for years in developing agents. That's who he is. And, you know, we certainly don't have presidents that have that skill set. I mean, and first of all, they try their best to tell the truth, for crying out loud.
Yep.
And that's noticeably different because of our value system. But he's there to manipulate Witkoff and convince him and bend him towards his will. And he what I was told, he walks out of there believing what he's hearing. And then what's remarkable, if you just read what his spokespeople are saying and what Lavrov says, that's completely different. They're much closer to telling the truth about what they're really about.
And I know.
Putin, you know, is persuading Wyckoff that he's sincere, that he really does want peace. And, you know, I'm really after the roots of the problem. The roots of the problem is a false narrative. Get this out of people's head, that because these Eastern European countries, who used to be under the communist regime, the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, dominated and put in place governments that were friendly to the Soviet Union in those countries. When that was removed in 91, those countries said to themselves, never again. And let's go to NATO and make certain that we don't have Russia do this to us again. That's what that was all about. It was defensive. There is no offensive capability on those borders to invade Russia. Russia keeps saying, you know, all these countries have become a part of NATO and they're after us and they're the enemy and we have to fight back at them. There is not a country, and certainly not NATO, has any intent,
of course,
to cross that border and invade Russia. It is done there for defensive reasons against Russia, not offensive reasons. And when you hear people in our government, in our Congress, and saying, well, the roots of this problem is because countries join NATO, and that's what Putin is upset about. Yeah, he's upset about it. But it's false to say that somehow that is threatening him. It is not threatening him at all.
General, it just bothers me. It doesn't bother me when Russians say that. It bothers me when Americans say that. It drives me nuts.
Yeah, I agree.
So lastly, just educate me on this. I saw Vladimir Putin. Why would he not recognize Donald Trump as his best opportunity for an off-ramp? And does he not understand, with all his KGB training, that if he embarrasses Trump, who has taken political risks and has already taken political hits for giving him an equal chance to stop this war, that he lost his one legitimate ally in the West? Why would he take that risk?
Well, because he thinks he can manipulate our president. And he's trying to go as far as he can until he gets pushed back. The only thing that Putin understands is being pushed back. And that's what he's doing, because he wants concessions. I mean, what are we talking about? He wants to demilitarize Ukraine. He wants to change their constitution. He wants to change their regime. He doesn't want peacekeepers in if there is a peace agreement. He's setting the stage for eventually, if he does go to an agreement, because, as I said, the pressure on him in 2025 will be pretty significant on the battlefield. He wants those concessions first, and he's trying to go as far as he can to get those. He's already got some concessions, obviously, and he wants to get more. And I think that's what he's about. He's gaming us. I think the president is, the president knows. He's not going to say it publicly, because that's not how he negotiates. He knows Putin's a thug. He knows he's a killer. He knows he's committed genocide. I know that for a fact, because I've conversed with him about that subject. But he wants to work with Putin to try to bring him in. I think he knows by now, and he said it publicly, that he thinks Putin is gaming him, and he's really stalling. And I think now the options are there for him to take a strong stand about this. I don't know what Wyckoff's last session with Putin is about. But I know they're talking about sanctions, and that's appropriate. But sanctions have never moved Putin.
Yep.
What will move Putin is increased military capability to the Ukrainians. Not so the Ukrainians can continue to war for 3 more years.
But, yeah, to be formidable.
To bring Putin to the negotiating table is the objective.
General, thanks so much. On behalf of my audience, you just brought us all down to back to earth and back to reality. General Jack Keane, thank you.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
All right, we are back, and coming up, We have a lot more left of the show, but that's it for this hour. By the way, if you want to see me on stage, and I know you do, History, Liberty, and Laughs. If you're patriotic, you want motivation, inspiration, I'm going to be on stage, and it's going to be June 21st. I'm going to be, as you know, in Dayton, Ohio. WHIO listeners especially, I hope to see you there in person. We're also going to be, that's June 21st at the Victoria Theater. Dallas, Texas, huge venue, Winspear Opera House. It's going to be August 23rd. It's going to be a show like no other. Beautiful venue in downtown Dallas. And then September 27th, Dominion Energy Center, Carpenter Theater, Richmond, Virginia, September 27th. Tickets are available. Hope to see everyone down there. BrianKilmeade.com. We also have videos to show you what you're getting into. It's a show like no other, and I think you really enjoy it. But more importantly, I'll have a chance to meet you in person.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Yes, I'm very approachable. You come up to me, unless you're protesting in front of my building, which happens every Tuesday at 1211 6th Avenue. I have no why, but I guess it's public land. Imagine just coming to work and just seeing a bunch of signs saying how bad your company is. We have to put up with that. I mean, it's unbelievable. And I got to walk through it. I mean, unless I want to stay in and go out the back door, which doesn't really, is not something I want to do. Martha McCallum at the bottom of the hour, fresh off her fantastic coverage at the Vatican. Today's kind of an exciting day. A lot going on at the White House, 101 days in. Today, they're going to have their cabinet meeting. I think it's the third one. Remember, Joe Biden had 8 in 4 years. This guy's had 3 in 3 months. And he's going to bring the key, said to bring the cameras in. You could ask any question you want, have all his people there. So it'll be, there's a lot to talk about. Also, the president is hosting a cabinet meeting, and the Senate Finance Committee is hearing to examine the nomination of Rodney Scott, handle the border. And now we have Senator Perdue is going to be Ambassador Perdue. He is going to be going over to China. Soon we'll get one over to Italy. We'll get everyone fully staffed. Let's go to Karl Rove right now, former deputy chief of staff, great friend of the show, to George W. Bush. And you know that he writes for The Wall Street Journal on a weekly basis. Karl, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. And wait a minute. You said 1211 Avenue of the Americas. I thought Fox News was located at 535 East 58th Street. I thought that was the address. For all of the people who are listening who want to protest, it's 538 East 58th.
Good. Way to go. I mean, Karl, you must deal with that a lot, right? Especially when you were with the Bush administration. You're trying to live your life, and then people think they have to give their opinion on the job you're doing, and it's negative. How do you deal with that?
Well, you know, that's their right, but it irritated me when they tried to, surround my house and pound on my windows when I had a 10-year-old inside.
So yeah.
that was more than just a little irritating, but we have a right of free speech here, and if we disagree, fine, but if we could find a less disagreeable way to disagree, it would be good for our country.
I hear you. So how do you feel about the president's tactic of letting the cameras come in and ask questions on these cabinet meetings and also almost speaking 2 or 3 times a day?
Yeah, it's a high wire act. It's really, because he's sort of tossing control of that day's message to whatever question the press wants to throw at him. But he's comfortable with it and he's carried it off pretty well. There's one thing that's going to be problematic. He sometimes gets things stuck in his head. Because somebody told him or somebody showed him something. And once it gets stuck there, he can get into a battle that he's not ultimately going to win. For example, somebody showed him a picture of the Marylander who got sent to El Salvador with MS-13 tattooed on his knuckles. Well, it's a completely photoshopped fake picture, but the president was shown it. Nobody said, hey, this is not real. It got sort of stuck in there. And sometimes he gets stuck in those kind of situations, and be better to be a little bit more, unwilling to accept on at first blush anything that's thrust in front of him.
I know you're not a fan like Steve Moore. Steve Moore, not a fan of the tariffs, looking for to resolve it. You're not a fan of the tariffs and the restructuring of trade all at once. So the market didn't like the GDP, which was -3%. Even though they got into detail, when you have a whole bunch of imports, it throws off the number on the total on the GDP. Having said all that, Do you think that makes Trump and the Treasury Secretary Bessent want to change the speed or the number of exemptions on the deals coming forward? It looks like South Korea is set to be announced, followed by India. Does that change anything?
I think it will. As long as what the agreements say to the American people are, we're not going to be paying higher prices when we go to outfit our kids or to make a purchase. Remember, look, one of the big difficulties facing the previous president, Joe Biden, was he went out there in 2021, 22, 23, and 24 and said Bidenomics is working. And the American people didn't feel it because they saw it in their life when they went to the grocery store, when they went to work, when they looked at their paycheck, tried to stretch it to pay the bills, went and filled the car up with gas. Same thing now because, look, Americans are working in this economy. And so when they go to work and somebody says, you know what, you're in an auto plant and we're now going to have to pay 25% tariff or a 50% tariff on something on a component that we import from Canada or Mexico, yeah. You know it's going to be reflected in the final price of the product you're selling. And you know it's going to cause some people to say, well, I want to find something cheaper or maybe I just won't buy a new car now. And so – And that feeds throughout the entire economy. We all feel this. I mean, it's not that the only people who know what's going on in a business are the people in the CEO's office. It's people on the floor. And so the president's got to be very careful in my mind of sort of dismissing people's concerns. I noticed in the NBC interview, it was like, you know, everything's going to turn out all right. We want to hear that reassurance, but back it up. And that's why these initial tariff deals are so critical. We need to be able to walk away from them and say, you know what? Vietnam lowered its tariffs and taxes on American goods and services to, you know, 5%. Therefore, you know, 5% U.S. Okay, fine. We can live with that. But these, you know, 90% tariffs and 45% tariffs, American people aren't dumb. They know who's going to end up paying most of that, and it's them.
Here is the Treasury Secretary, Cut 22.
Vice President Vance was in India last week. I think that he and Modi made some very good progress, so I could see some announcements on India. I could see the contours of a deal with the Republic of Korea coming together, and then we've had substantial talks with the Japanese. I think that we are very close on India.
So, obviously, he's not somebody to get into hyperbole. He's as right. Straight down the road as anybody, right?
Yes, and actually, ironically, for weird reasons, I have some knowledge of what's going on in two of those countries that he's talking about, and I think he's absolutely right. The U.S. is making serious progress with South Korea and Japan, in part because two things. One is their economies are tied to ours. I mean, they understand that high tariffs on American goods and high tariffs on their goods are going to be problematic for their economies. And second of all, they realize that we need to, as a world, we face a difficult time, and they have made a decision they want to be allied with the United States and not have to kowtow to China. And so they're looking to strengthen that relationship. And look, don't get me wrong, some of this is inexplicable. The president says if we have a trade deficit, you're screwing us. You're being unfair to us. So why do we turn around and slap a tariff on countries with whom we have a surplus, like Great Britain and the Netherlands, or other countries? And why not take into account that we're selling not only goods, but we're also selling services? And those matter a lot in an economy like ours that increasingly more and more of it is derived from the sale of services. And so, you know, he's got a chance to have some real successes here. He's going to have to deliver, and I think I'm really impressed with this trade, with the trading skills of the Secretary of the Treasury, and hopefully we'll have some good deals here shortly.
And Karl Rove, let me ask you, the answer might be, I don't know, and that's what most people say. But when it comes to China, do you get the sense that they're feeling it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, the numbers on the collapse of their manufacturing economy here, they had a burst earlier in the year because – and when the president came in, people said, you know what, we better stock up our inventories. The latest GDP numbers, this blows my mind. There is a 22% in equipment spending. Clearly, that's being driven by companies saying, we better spend on the equipment that we're buying from China and get it here quickly. That added 1.1 percentage points to the GDP number. But then we had a 2.3% point boost from inventory accumulation, but then we had a 5% decline in the GDP from the import surge. So the real GDP is at a positive but tepid, 1.3 number. And I think that's going to weigh heavily on China, because China realizes, they're no longer going to be able to pay those employees and millions of jobs and thousands of factories across China if they are not able to sell to the United States.
And Carl, the thing we have to learn from this, and we should have done it ahead of time clearly, is we got to get our own magnets, our own precious metals, our own rare earth. We have to find other places to refine it. We cannot count on them ever again. Pharmaceuticals already have to come back. Chips in Taiwan, if we're in the process of doing that, that's national security. That's different from trade. Don't tell me about profit. You bring them home for national security reasons, almost like the Defense Production Act in an emergency situation, because I believe China is, if I'm to read the reports, that it'd be correct. China's already holding back magnets and metals.
Yeah, absolutely they are. But here's one other thing that we better get our act together on. For the last 8 years, we've done nothing on the biggest problem we have dealing with China on trade issues. And what is that? That's the theft of intellectual property. If you want to sell into China, you have to have a Chinese partner who has access to your manufacturing and technology. Even after that partnership ends, if you want to sell to the Chinese government, which is the biggest client in China, you have to manufacture in China. These are in violation of WTO rules. And both this president in his first term and Joe Biden in his term did nothing to undo these trading practices, which have accelerated since 2012 and the rise of Xi, the leader of China. So we ought to be getting the world community. You think the Brits like having their technology stolen, or the Indians or the Japanese? So we ought to get the world united, go to the WTO and say, China, you made a series of commitments when you joined. You're not living up to them. Either live up to them or you're out.
Yeah, by the way, Messin is meeting with the IMF and WTO, and he's got a list of grievances, and I think he's got he's empowered to act. Lastly, something totally different on the media and the failings of Joe Biden that you wrote about, I've talked about, and it was obvious to all of us, and now people on the left are writing books trying to make money off Joe Biden's cognitive failings. Here's what Chuck Todd said when people come out and want to blame the media. Cut 37.
This is not a media failure. This is a failure of the Democratic Party. And I just sort of the virtue signaling that some people have done to try to say that the media missed this story. They didn't miss this story. Sure. David Ignatius wrote, I just refuse to accept this stupid premise, because it's a right-wing manufactured right-wing premise in order to stain the media.
Right-wing premise? What is she talking about?
Yeah. Look, except grow up. Accept the responsibility. The media were complicit in this. They were complicit. And we now know that the White House staff was misleading us. But I'm reading a couple of these books. I'm reading Uncharted by Whipple and Fight by Alan Parnas. And both of them talk about how members of the media say, we saw that he was in decline, but didn't write about it, didn't make it an issue. Some of them saw up close and personal or from sources that had knowledge that he was in bad shape and didn't talk about it. And look, if change the name, what if it was a Donald Trump or a George W. Bush or a Ronald Reagan? I mean, Reagan, they wrote about.
In real time,
the idea that the media was somehow doing its job with Joe Biden when he was hiding from the public, this goes back to his campaign, but certainly when he became president, now they're admitting, yeah, we saw him in 2021 and 2022, and he was so different from where we had seen him in 2016, and obvious decline. And we heard about the fundraiser in 2023 where big donors were horrified. Well, why didn't you write about it? Why did it take June 27th of 2024 and a performance on a stage in front of tens of millions of Americans, which you could not deny, to finally shock you into covering the mental decline of the president of the United States?
I hear you. And listen to what Alex Thompson of Axios said at the correspondence dinner.
President Biden's decline and its cover-up by the people around him is a reminder that every White House, regardless of party, is capable of deception. But being truth tellers also means telling the truth about ourselves. We, myself included, missed a lot of this story. And some people trust us less because of it.
Now, here's the problem. And he wrote the other book. He wrote another book. It's about to come out with Jake Tapper, of all people. They chose to miss the story. They knew the story was there. They chose not to write it. I guess he was better than most, but we were looked at as being cruel to old people by pointing out that he couldn't walk off a stage or across a lawn, that he couldn't walk up steps and had to change his shoes, and the way he leaves a plane, and the way he gets off stage, and then a guy dressed up in a rabbit outfit on Easter had to keep him away from the press, or it might have been a woman. Your final thought on this?
You know, ultimately, this is a responsibility of Joe Biden and the people around him, and they ill-serve the country. They ill-serve their own party. They hurt our country. The idea that he was going to run again for re-election was horrifying. But think back. It may have been that the fact that he ran in 2020 was the beginning of the problem. They knew back then that he was in decline. But to hide it from the American people and now say, well, yeah, we knew. We were horrified. I'm reading about the debate prep here. Well, you know, you put him there, and you kept him there, and you hid him from us, and you misled us about him, and it hurt our country. Our country needs to have a strong, effective president, regardless of whether they're Republican or Democrat. And your man was not up to the job. And you hid it from the American people.
He did. And the thing is, they're trying to get a pass without ever admitting the whole Russia trumped up hoax. You went through it to a degree with the Scooter Libby situation. And so that was this is all to the 100th power. And they just want to keep moving on and get their awards. It's crazy. I'm not perfect. Well, at least I try to be.
Yeah. Well, and there's one other thing, which is now they're saying, well, the president doesn't have the power to suspend this spending. He can't stop spending the money on the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and blah, 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 blah. These are the same people who said, oh, it's okay if the president takes $870 billion worth of taxpayer dollars in student loan monies and writes it off without a vote of Congress. Because you know why? The White House says on background, we're doing this because we're worried about the youth vote in the midterms and the presidential election. And we think this will help us with younger voters. I mean, please.
Karl Rove. Great points, as usual. I got you all fired up. Best of luck the rest of the day. You owe me for everything you achieve from here on in today. It's because you're on our show. Thanks, Karl Rove.
Illuminating, intriguing, inculcating.
I know some of these words.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So I have a surprise for you. Martha McCallum is here already. She's getting to host her show at 3 o'clock today. Martha, fresh off the Vatican. Of course, I'm going to review the expense report personally. You've had a problem in the past. But your thoughts about your show today at 3?
Well, we're going to talk to Governor Andy Beshear about Democrats' efforts to find some sort of foundation to rebuild and what he thinks about it. What he thinks about Governor Whitmer making her second appearance alongside President Trump. I find all of that really interesting. And also General Keith Kellogg, as we now have a couple of people from the administration suggesting that, you know, that every effort's been made to end the war in Ukraine, but it's possible that it's not going to happen. So we'll find out what that's about.
Well, are we going to arm them up or just leave? That's the big question.
That's the big question.
We have to arm them up. Doubt it. But we should.
I mean, I thought the meeting between Zelensky and Trump at the Vatican last week was so fascinating. And it sends a signal, obviously, to Putin that he's sitting down with him in the middle of the Vatican after their really rocky Oval Office meeting. So I think there's a lot moving.
Yeah, I mean, that ends up being one of the bigger image than the Pope dying. I hate to tell you. And the president said, that's the nicest office I ever had. St. Peter's Basilica. Back with more on Martha in a moment.
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
The other change for Belichick is 24-year-old Jordan Hudson, his creative muse, as he writes in his book. Jordan was a constant presence during our interview.
You have Jordan right over there. Everybody in the world seems to be following this relationship.
They've got an opinion about your private life. It's got nothing to do with them, but they're invested in it. How do you deal with that?
Never been too worried about what everybody else thinks. Just try to do what I feel like is best for me and what's right.
How did you guys meet?
Not talking about this.
No?
No.
So that was the story on CBS where Bill Belichick attempting to sell his book on winning was shut down by the 24-year-old girlfriend of Bill Belichick, now head coach of the University of North Carolina. Relationship expert and network anchor Martha McCallum joins us now from the story. Analyze that exchange.
First of all, I think that just watching Bill Belichick promote a book is a painful experience because he doesn't like to talk.
I know.
He doesn't want to elaborate on anything. He doesn't want to say like, oh, I got this great little story I want to share with you. It's just an anecdote from my book. One time, you know, Tom Brady and I, whatever. No, it's so painful for him. And when the reporter was pressing him on why there's not one mention of Robert Kraft, even in the acknowledgments, he was like, it was like watching a post-Patriots press conference. He's like, nope, nope.
Yeah. Didn't include him. Had to cut it out. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, it wasn't in there. Nope. Right. And then she pipes up and it is, it's just very weird. The whole thing is very weird. I'm not sure that the entire country is spending a lot of time thinking about their relationship, as the reporter suggested on the way into the question, but it is what it is.
So the University of North Carolina says they're concerned because they say that she is everywhere. She's handling his appearances, handling where he's going.
Doesn't usually turn out well, does it?
Never.
I'm thinking about that, you know, the woman that Tiger Woods was dating for a while, and people said the same thing about her.
Yeah.
That she was always around, that she was always involved and sort of like hanging on to the whole situation. I think that generally doesn't turn out too well.
Martha, the other thing is, like, do you see Bill Belichick in odd poses? She's dressed as a mermaid and he's fishing.
How weird is that?
Nothing weirder, ever. Nothing weird.
And he's like, oh, I don't really look at it. Like she's like, come on, I'm dressed up like a mermaid, and you can pretend like you're reeling me in, and then I'm going to put it all over social media. I mean, whatever. I mean, whatever they're into. But to have that be part of the book promo, probably not too helpful.
Well, put it this way. Does he do another interview for it? I mean, he gets money. You know what it's like. You have a book out. You got to promote it.
You do have to promote it. But, you know, she's clearly the media manager. And I don't know how much experience she has, but she thinks that when she pipes up in the middle of it, that means they're going to cut that part out. Hello? That is not how it works.
Right.
She's like, no, we're not going to talk about that. She's not thinking this is what's going to be viral. But of course it is. So right. That was a big lesson for her.
The other thing is, it's people who watched him not say words for years and be the toughest guy, taking on a 6'8", 320-pound lineman who shows up late. He'll confront him and rugged him, cut players on the spot. All of a sudden, you see him knuckle under a 24-year-old who knows nothing about life. It doesn't even matter.
Oh, men do that all the time.
Huh? You mean a 24-year-old man controlling women?
No, I'm just saying, you know, it's sort of like, what's that saying? There's no fool like an old fool. I don't know.
Do people say that?
In general?
Oh.
Sure. Oh. There's no fool like an old fool. You never heard that?
No, I never really heard that.
Really?
Yeah.
That's because you're not an old fool yet.
But, I hope not.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, there's something fairly predictable about it. And, you know, I know, remember at the roast, the Brady roast, they were all ribbing him about this relationship.
But here's the other thing that's interesting. It's like when you have this focus, he's like a genius and he spends most of his time in the film room, not interacting with people, working 18 hours a day. So what happens is it's like the Tiger Woods imbalance. You only do one thing your whole life. And at some point you pick your head up and you go, wow, not only am I'm not really good to socially, but I'm famous and I'm rich and other people just come in and you have no way of judging people's motives or what they're up to or you don't have that
social skills are not really there. And
we're street smart.
He's a genius coach. And I loved watching him coach the Patriots all those years. The relationship that he had with Tom Brady was extraordinary. So but it was productive.
Yes.
I mean, incredibly productive. So they were doing something right? They had an incredible relationship in that way. And it produced amazing football. I loved that clip that they played of, you know, when they played against the Falcons and came back, you know, scored 21 points in like the last, whatever it was, 5 minutes or something. But, you know, and I don't mean to be if they're happy, more power to them. And I hope they are. I hope they live happily ever after. But if she can't pipe up in the middle of it and not have the rest of us go, oh, okay, now we're going to talk about it,
right?
Because it brought it out there for everyone to see.
I mean, we put the request in to interview him. I mean, I have a lot of legitimate questions. I might not focus on the social part of it. I really don't care that much.
Is this your pitch? Please come here.
Yes, if he's listening right now.
And she could come with him and sit right here next to where I'm sitting right now?
As long as we keep the camera on
I think it'd be very interesting.
That would probably be even more interesting.
Absolutely.
Right.
I hope he does that with you.
Well, what's going to be interesting is because Bob Kraft and he obviously were on the outs. That's one thing.
Yeah.
So
than we knew, I guess.
And he said, well, Bob Kraft said he fired you. And he said, no, I quit. Because I know he said he fired you.
He said we parted ways.
Yeah, we parted ways. So that's a huge difference. And now it looks like Parcells and Bob Kraft have made up.
Right, so now the book promo interview has become about his 24-year-old girlfriend interjecting and reeling him in a way that most men I don't think would find
You know, it's almost as bad, Alec
And then
Baldwin.
It's about him saying he was fired.
Eric, do you have the one with Alec Baldwin on the red carpet? This is terrible. By the way, this is on the heels of another story. I'm doing Outnumbered at the top of the hour. I think I'm going to be the man. You never know. And one of the stories is Amal Clooney and George Clooney in an interview. And say evidently she could be banned from this country for her role as one of eight members of the International Criminal Court who voted to indict Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense minister, Gallant. And she could be banned from the country. And then as I'm researching this, I see this story. George Clooney says he and his wife have never had a fight in over 10 years of marriage. Is that possible?
Not in my house, but it might be possible in their house, and more power to them if that's true. They always look pretty happy. But yeah, that seems like a bit of a stretch, doesn't it? I mean, does that mean
formal,
like over anything, over like, oh, are you going to wear that tie? You know what I mean? Like nothing? Or does he mean, you know, just like a huge blowout fight?
They just don't have a fight. If you don't have a fight, I don't think you're in a real relationship. Because that means you're like, it's in the dating stage still. Like where you're looking to put your best. And if you're doing that, like, that's never going to
work. I just love everything you do and you love everything I do.
Right.
And I'm
afraid of being the one to blow it.
Yeah, exactly.
Until you realize you're in. The other story, I only caught the tail end of it, but evidently there's this new trend that is being introduced where marriage could be like a couple of contracts, like a 4-year contract. Instead of a lifetime contract, a 4-year contract. Do you think that could ever work where people will be more on their toes because they know they could be renewed or not be renewed?
No, I mean, I'm a Catholic. I got married in a Catholic church. It's a forever agreement. It is not a 4-year agreement. It's a vow. You take a vow to love someone and cherish them for the rest of your life. I think the 4-year agreement plan is just a totally different version of it than I would ever.
What if you take a vow for 4 years?
No,
oh, you wouldn't?
It's a life. It's like swans. You know, they mate for life.
Oh, is that true?
Swans mate for life. That's why you always see two of them, you know, together on the pond.
But like, how do they meet? I mean, is it arranged? Is like the first swan
Pinch?
You see?
I don't know.
This is a fantastic conversation. By the way, the cabinet meeting is starting with the President of the United States puts on his own show every day. Fresh up his show at night. He has his own show with his cabinet. This is his third one. And we're looking at what's going on right now. So Russia, Ukraine, we talked in real life about in the break on this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm concerned, like you sound like you may be concerned, that we might be laying the groundwork to walk away. I think this could be if Zelensky ends up dead and Kyiv ends up falling and we walked away, this will be his version of Afghanistan. Even though he didn't start when he was there. It started actually when Biden was there as senator, but Afghanistan.
Well, you can sense Secretary of State Rubio, who's sitting right next to the president right now live as they do this cabinet meeting, said several days ago, maybe it doesn't work. Maybe we don't get the ceasefire. You know, we're working as hard as we can, but maybe we don't. Maybe it doesn't happen. And obviously it was something that the president said could be handled in a few days. And then you had Susie Wild in the interview with the New York Post say something similar, that we can make the absolute best effort we can make, but if they want to keep killing each other, then that's the way it's going to be. What hasn't really been articulated is what kind of terms, what would our support look like? And really, understanding what happened between Zelensky and Trump in the Vatican the other day, and hopefully a move towards some peace and some assurances of some kind of security for Ukraine. But there's a lot of huge question marks around this right now.
Right now, Lavrov says we want the world to recognize Crimea and the 20% of Ukraine that we've taken. He names all the provinces. And then he also he wants to make sure they're disarmed, wants to disarm Ukraine. That's never gonna, none of this stuff is going to happen.
Smaller military.
Yeah, smaller military, if not totally disarmed. And Lavrov says that he explained that to Witkoff. Mm-hmm. Witkoff didn't say anything about that when he came out. So you're either stabbing him in the back. Witkoff is not somebody, I don't think he's playing that game. I'll tell American people the opposite of what happened. So I hope people realize what we realized really through George W. Bush, that we can't be trusted. He's got to be in a point where it's in his best interest to stop fighting. And the only way to do that is to continue to flow, arm up massively Ukraine. He's already lost 900,000 plus off the battlefield, dead or wounded. And that's the only thing he seems to understand, Martha.
I don't know what makes Putin stop in his tracks at this point. I think he feels, perhaps, that he can get what he wants. He can get Crimea. He can get the 20% that they've been holding. There's been very little forward movement over the course of this war, even from the very early days. So I think he, but that's why I think this meeting between Zelensky and Trump at the Vatican probably raised a lot of questions. And I think it may have been President Trump's way of saying, look, you know, you're not going to keep bombing Ukraine. We're supposed to be working towards a ceasefire. And if you do, I'm going to try to figure out another. I'm going to maybe figure out another alliance, another way forward here.
The other thing, Martha, is, as you know, the president's taking political risk and political hits by giving Vladimir Putin a fresh start, saying we'll give you a problem with the economy. And I thought Putin would have recognized that and wouldn't have made the president look so bad. If it ends now, the way it ends, where it's heading, he makes the president look terrible. He's going to hold a grudge on that. And this was his chance to have economic development with anybody.
But I mean, absolutely. I agree with you, Brian. Think about the irony here. The entire Russiagate catastrophe of the first term and the suggestion that, you know, oh, that Putin was in Trump's back pocket, right, all along.
Yes.
Just
Boy,
and Trump was always stronger on giving Ukraine support. He gave Ukraine way more support than they ever got from Biden or from Obama. But now it's getting to a point where, you know, I think that the gig may be up. And I think that the choice that the United States makes may have to be to continue to support Ukraine.
I like the way you did that, because we outlined three stories that are cliffhangers to only be continued on your show. At 3
exactly.
o'clock on Fox
General
News.
General Keith Kellogg will ask him the questions about where all this is going.
And then he'll answer, won't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
We're not going to let him off the hook.
All right, back with more to know in just a moment. Top of the hour on Outnumbered. This is Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move. Thank you, Martha.
More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Do you go out of your way to be apolitical when people ask you these things? Do you try to, does the entertainment business part of you say, let's stay away?
I think a big thing for me is that, you know, if our friend wanted to come hang out with us, take a photo with us, or go play golf, you know who I'm talking about.
Oh.
We got to go take a photo with him.
President Trump.
Mr. Trump, yes.
Yeah.
You know, I watched the video of him and DeChambeau playing golf, and I was like, man, that'd be a lot of fun going to play golf with those two.
Right.
And I'm always outspoken about my faith. I think that, you know, I don't go out of my way to ever push it down someone's throat or anything like that. But any chance I get, I always make sure that I give him all the glory and showcase.
Right.
My conservative values and, you know, my Christian beliefs.
Right. So that's Warren Zeiders trying to stay apolitical, but definitely is pro-Trump. I had did a feature with him right by Madison Square Garden. So Warren Zeiders I thought a pretty cool feature with us on Sunday. Who is he? He's got four number ones in the country music charts. Where did he come from? During the pandemic, he put down the lacrosse stick, picked up the guitar, and just wowed everybody on YouTube. By the time we come out of it, he ends up with an agent. He ends up with a series, with a record deal. And he's been hitting the ground running ever since, selling out the Garden and other venues. But President Trump watched that. At which time he tweeted, said nice things about it, put it on Truth Social. Then an article comes out that just says, why is Donald Trump posting about Warren Zeiders? He must think he's Warren Zevon. I got news for you, idiot. He does know it's Warrensiders. He says he's an up-and-comer, recognized some of his songs, and loved the comments he made about him and Bryson DeChambeau. So don't act like you know everything. That is it. Next, Melania Trump might be the most popular Trump, and certainly the most popular in the president's cabinet. It turns out the First Lady is who makes rare public appearances, but did pass a key piece of legislation this week. According to the Daily Mail pollster, they asked Americans to rate the president, the vice president, a handful of other cabinet members. The lady, the First Lady, is plus 13, with 30% of respondents viewing her favorably, another 15 viewing her somewhat favorably. Those numbers are identical to her husband's. Pretty cool. 24% of respondents rated Melania very unfavorably. Next. Netflix CEO Ted Sarandos says the traditional theater experience is outdated for most, and the audiences have made it clear they'd rather watch films at their house. He said that during the Time 100 Summit last week. The editor-chief of Time, Sam Jacobs, listed a series of troubles for Hollywood, including lower box office, struggling L.A. film industry. He added that Netflix was thriving and pointedly asked the head of the streaming giant, "Have you destroyed Hollywood?" I don't know. What do you think? Do you still think movies? Do you think movies are dead?
I don't think they're dead. I think they're great. The thing is, though, if you can stay at home to watch it and like buy it on Amazon or Netflix, when you have a bunch of kids, sometimes it's just the more economical thing to do, because going to the movies with your whole family is like over $100 now.
Oh yeah, that's right. Because it's now they have lounge chairs, they have waitress service that costs money. He says we're saving Hollywood. You mentioned that the box office being down. What does that what does that say? What is a consumer trying to tell us? That they'd like to watch movies at home. Guess what? Less money in it, too. You're not getting any back end if you do a movie and it goes on streaming, correct? Number three is Hollywood. The reason why no one shoots in Hollywood right now, all the taxes, all the regulations. People just go to Canada. I mean, they are doing, couldn't believe this. Rob Lowe says they are shooting Fox's The Floor, which is a game show, in Ireland because of the tax incentives there. It's crazy.
And then actually, even, Brian, they're shooting so many movies in New Jersey right now.
Yeah.
Same thing, just the tax incentives.
A friend of mine, the Goss family, opened up a theater in New Jersey, a studio in New Jersey, sold out nonstop. In fact, they did some of Happy Gilmore there. Next, Doug Emhoff is angry, lashing out at President Trump for removing him from the Holocaust Memorial Council. Emhoff was upset, says he received news of the dismissal from the council. Emhoff took to social media to slam the administration. He says, "Today I was informed of my removal. Let me be clear. Holocaust remembrance and education should never be politicized. I have news for you. You said nothing during the anti-Semitic protests with Harvard and Columbia and Yale and SUNY and the city colleges and NYU. Nothing. No one saw you at all. So, plus, Trump doesn't trust you. You want him to, people who are friendly with Trump telling you things so you can run back to the Democratic Party? No thanks.
It is time to take the quiz.
It's five questions in less than 5 minutes. We ask people on the streets of New York City to play along. Let's see how you do.
Take the quiz every day at thequiz.fox. Then come back here to see how you did.
Thank you for taking the quiz.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.